You reach into your wallet, you pull out a $20 bill, and what do you actually see?
Well, it just feels like a piece of paper, right?
Yeah, exactly. Some green ink, a portrait of Andrew Jackson. You hand it over for a coffee, and the barista hands you a cup. It feels totally finite. It just feels completely local.
But the moment you look past that single everyday physical transaction, the boundaries of that paper just kind of dissolve.
Right.
You realize you aren't looking at a standalone object at all. You're actually looking at a single node in a massive, invisible global network.
And that is exactly what we are getting into today. Welcome to the deep dive, everyone. Our mission today is to completely reframe how you think about the money sitting in your bank account right now.
Absolutely.
Whether you are, actively managing an investment portfolio or you just want to make sense of the macroeconomic headlines flashing across your screen, we are going to give you the ultimate shortcut to understanding global liquidity. And we're going to do it by translating all this heavy financial architecture into plain language.
And our guiding source for this is a really highly comprehensive institutional analysis. It's titled The U.S. Dollar as the Core System of Global Finance.
Yes.
This was jointly published today, actually, June 20, 2026, by the American newspaper and American TV. And it synthesizes decades of financial plumbing into a very stark thesis.
And that thesis is honestly a total paradigm shift. I mean, the premise here is that the US dollar is not actually just a currency. It is the underlying operating system of global capitalism.
Exactly. If we connect this to the bigger picture, to understand why the dollar operates like a global OS, we really have to stop looking at the physical banknote and start examining the balance sheet of the entire world.
Great, the big picture.
Yeah, because global banks borrow dollars to fund operations, massive international conglomerates invoice their goods in dollars, and sovereign governments hold their emergency reserves in dollars.
Okay, let's unpack this using that technology analogy because I feel like it makes the invisible visible for a lot of
It
people.
really does.
So the dollar is basically like iOS's Windows. It is the background infrastructure, the base code that all the world's financial apps run on.
Yeah.
You don't necessarily see the code when you're tapping the app on your screen, but if that base layer fails, the entire system crashes.
That analogy holds up perfectly, actually, when you look at the four practical functions of this system. First, it serves as the global pricing language.
Okay.
So if a European airline decides to buy aircraft from a French manufacturer, or, if crude oil is moving from Saudi Arabia to a port in Japan, those contracts are priced and settled in dollars.
Even though there isn't a single American involved in the trade,
Exactly.
though it is the universal translation layer for global commerce.
Exactly. Second, it acts as the global funding currency. Non-U.S. banks and multinational corporations, they issue debt in dollars because the investor pool is just incredibly deep.
Right.
Third, it provides the ultimate collateral base. U.S. Treasury bonds basically sit at the absolute center of global risk-free lending.
Yeah, they're the foundation.
And fourth, it operates as the ultimate crisis refuge. Whenever a macro shock hits anywhere on Earth, global capital immediately scrambles for dollars to repay debts and secure highly liquid assets.
And that specific point, it always highlights a really counterintuitive piece of engineering to me.
How so?
Well, even if a financial crisis originates inside the United States, global capital still floods into the dollar. I mean, it's wild. But obviously, this global operating system didn't just, appear out of thin air. Somebody had to write the original code.
Right, and the initial architecture was built on hardware, essentially. If we look back at the classical gold standard in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, the system relied entirely on metallic credibility.
Meaning physical gold.
Yes, national currencies were rigidly pegged to physical gold
And this
reserves.
was a hard-coded physical limitation on the system.
Exactly, and it was a pretty brutal operating environment. If a country ran a trade deficit, physical gold literally had to leave their vaults. Yeah, that meant domestic credit instantly contracted, leading to severe domestic deflation. It was a system that fundamentally just could not scale with modern industrial growth.
Right, because there's only so much gold.
Right. And it eventually cracked under the massive economic pressures of the World Wars and the Great Depression.
So the global economy essentially needed a massive patch, like a full system reboot.
Yeah, and that reboot took place in 1944 at the Bretton Woods Conference. The Allied nations basically gathered to design a completely new monetary architecture.
Enter the dollar.
Exactly. Because the United States emerged with the strongest intact industrial base and held enormous physical gold reserves, the new code pegged all major global currencies to the U.S. dollar.
And then pegged the dollar to gold at a fixed rate of $35 an ounce.
You got it. The dollar became the crucial API bridge, essentially connecting national currencies to physical gold.
But anytime you try to scale software that fast, you're going to hit a bug. And the analysis here highlights a massive one called the Triffin dilemma. Let's break this down, because it is the paradox that almost broke the system.
What's really fascinating here is the sheer mathematical contradiction of the Triffin dilemma. Post-war Europe and Asia, you know, they were rebuilding rapidly.
Right.
They desperately needed an injection of dollars for trade liquidity. To supply the network with those dollars, the U.S. had to consistently run external deficits, pumping cash outward.
Okay, so the U.S. has to send dollars out into the world.
Yes. But the more dollars the U.S. pushed into the global network, the more foreign central banks started looking at their growing dollar reserves and wondering if the U.S. actually had enough physical gold in Fort Knox to back all those claims up.
Ah, so you have to print more money to keep the global network running.
Yeah.
But printing more money mechanically dilutes the trust in the money you just printed.
Exactly. The scaling demands of the software fundamentally exceeded the limits of the hardware. And this culminated in the 1971 Nixon shock.
Right, 1971.
The U.S. was facing rising domestic inflation and massive fiscal pressures from overseas commitments. Foreign nations began aggressively redeeming their dollars for physical gold.
They were cashing out.
Yeah, the drain became completely unsustainable. So in August 1971, President Nixon simply severed the link. He suspended the convertibility of the dollar into gold.
Which brings us to this incredible pivot in financial history. I mean, you would assume that pulling the plug on the physical hardware gold backing would crash the entire software system.
That would be the logical assumption, yeah.
But the network didn't collapse. It actually scaled exponentially. Stripping away the gold birthed these massive new offshore markets, specifically the petrodollar and the eurodollar market.
Right.
Because global commodities like oil were still priced in dollars, exporters simply took those dollar revenues and recycled them back through Western banking networks.
The paradigm shifted basically overnight. The operating system moved from metallic credibility to institutional credibility.
That's a huge shift.
It was no longer backed by a shiny rock in a vault. Mm-hmm. It was backed by the tax-generating capacity of the U.S. economy, the credibility of the Federal Reserve, the unprecedented depth of U.S. capital markets, and, you know, the legal enforceability of contracts.
So they successfully moved the whole system to the cloud. But if we are running on pure institutional credibility today, what actually makes up the server farms? Like, what are the load-bearing pillars keeping this network online right now?
Well, the current data reveals just a staggering level of dominance. As of June 2026, the report states the U.S. dollar constitutes 56.77% of all allocated global foreign exchange reserves.
Over half. That's wild.
And furthermore, the dollar is on one side of 89.2% of all over-the-counter foreign exchange trades globally.
Wait, let's quickly define over-the-counter for anyone listening who isn't a currency trader. We are talking about massive, decentralized, bank-to-bank transactions rather than trades happening on a public exchange like the New York Stock Exchange, correct?
That is the core distinction, yes. It is a direct peer-to-peer interbank network. And the dollar is involved in nearly 9 out of every 10 transactions that occur within it.
9 out of 10. Unbelievable.
But the ultimate anchor, you know, the real foundation of the server farm, is the U.S. Treasury market. By May 2026, there are $30.9 trillion in Treasury securities outstanding.
$30.9 trillion.
Yes. And they trade at an average volume of $1.24 trillion every single day.
Over $1 trillion moving daily. I mean, it is almost impossible to conceptualize that kind of liquidity.
And that liquidity is precisely why it serves as the first pillar. The U.S. Treasury market provides the deepest pool of nominally safe collateral on Earth.
Right.
The second pillar is the Federal Reserve itself, functioning effectively as the central bank of global dollar funding.
Through the swap lines, right?
Exactly. Through mechanisms called swap lines, the Fed provides guaranteed bandwidth during a crisis. This ensures foreign central banks can access emergency dollars so their local banking systems don't just freeze up.
Add to that the SWIFT messaging system, which acts as the global API, allowing banks to securely move claims across borders.
Very important part of the stack.
Yeah. And then you have the U.S. legal system enforcing property rights and U.S. military alliances projecting the geopolitical stability required for a $30 trillion collateral market to even exist safely in the first place.
It creates this massive self-reinforcing loop. Foreign central banks buy U.S. treasuries because they know the market is incredibly liquid.
Yeah.
The market remains liquid because global institutions are constantly trading them. And corporations invoice in dollars because the banking sector finances in dollars.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though, and I have to push back a bit on this.
Okay, go ahead.
If this dominance is largely a network effect based on size and utility, why haven't we seen a massive economic powerhouse like China or the European Union build a competing operating system? I mean, they certainly have the GDP to back it up.
That is the crucial question facing macroeconomics today. And the institutional analysis makes it very clear that sheer GDP scale is just not enough to mint a global reserve currency.
You need something else.
You require capital markets that are not just massive, but completely open, deeply trusted, and highly liquid.
Okay.
China's yuan possesses incredible trade scale due to their manufacturing dominance. However, its adoption is severely capped by structural capital controls and policy opacity.
Meaning you can't get your money out easily.
Precisely. A global asset manager needs absolute certainty that they can pull $1 billion out of a jurisdiction just as easily as they put it in, without facing sudden political friction or a closed API.
So China has a massive internal intranet, but the global market needs an open source internet.
That's a great way to put it.
What about the euro then? Because Europe has open capital markets and strong property rights.
The euro absolutely stands as the most credible conventional alternative. They possess the economic scale and the requisite rule of law. What they lack is a unified fiscal safe asset.
Ah, because of the politics.
Right. Because the European Union is politically fragmented, there is no single European treasury bond that matches the depth and universal acceptance of U.S. treasuries.
So they essentially have a fragmented server base.
Exactly. Until they achieve a unified fiscal sovereign, the euro functions as a vital regional network, but it simply cannot replace the core global standard.
But being the core standard comes with massive consequences for everyone else. If the dollar is the underlying code everyone is forced to run, what happens when the U.S. Federal Reserve decides to push a system update? Let's talk about the ripple effect of a fluctuating dollar.
Well, the dollar's value constantly shifts based on several macroeconomic drivers. Interest rate differentials are probably paramount.
Okay, explain that.
If U.S. interest rates rise higher than those in foreign economies, global capital naturally flows into the U.S. seeking that higher yield, and that mechanically strengthens the dollar.
Makes sense.
Inflation credibility also plays a role. If inflation rises, but the Fed demonstrates a credible commitment to fighting it, the currency strengthens. If that credibility wavers, the dollar weakens.
Now, if you are watching the evening financial news, you usually hear the anchor quote the DXY index as the ultimate measure of the dollar. Is that accurate?
The DXY is the most common market shorthand, definitely. But it is actually heavily skewed toward the euro. The data suggests that broad trade-weighted indexes, which are calculated by the Federal Reserve, provide a much more accurate picture of how the dollar is actually performing against the wider spectrum of global trading partners.
Let's frame this from the perspective of you, the listener. If you follow domestic politics, a strong dollar is almost always pitched as a victory, right?
Yeah, usually.
It sounds inherently good. It means cheaper imported electronics and cheaper European vacations for American consumers. It helps keep domestic inflation down. But if you step outside the U.S., a strong dollar is essentially a systemic wrecking ball. Walk us through the mechanics of that destruction.
Well, we established earlier that the dollar is the global funding currency. Multinational corporations in developing nations routinely issue debt denominated in U.S. dollars.
Right.
So if you operate a manufacturing firm in an emerging market, you earn your daily revenue in your local currency. But if your corporate debt must be paid back in dollars, a surging dollar means the underlying cost of your debt just exploded.
Even if your actual business operations haven't changed at all.
Exactly. It mechanically triggers a massive tightening of global financial conditions.
So it just suffocates them.
Precisely. Furthermore, capital begins fleeing those emerging markets to capture the safety and higher yield of U.S. assets.
Double whammy.
And simultaneously, crucial commodities like imported energy and basic food staples, which are priced in dollars globally, become wildly expensive for those local populations.
South Korea is highlighted as the perfect case study here in the report. And this is vital because South Korea is not some fragile developing economy.
Far from it.
Right. They possess a massive advanced industrial base. They are a leading global tech exporter, and they hold substantial foreign reserves. Yet the exchange rate between the US dollar and the Korean won is a massive structural macro variable for their entire economy.
And that vulnerability exists because they are intensely exposed to the global business cycle. They import massive amounts of energy to run their semiconductor fabs and industrial plants.
And that energy is priced in dollars.
Yes. So when the Federal Reserve pushes an update that strengthens the dollar, South Korea's energy input costs skyrocket, while their dollar-denominated funding tightens simultaneously.
And there is a fascinating mechanical point here regarding how this affects an individual investor. If a retail investor sitting in Seoul decides to buy U.S. tech stocks, they aren't just making a bet on a technology company. They are basically forced to manage two entirely separate return streams.
Yeah, they face both the asset return and the currency return.
Right.
If you buy a U.S. equity and the stock appreciates by 10%, that looks like a successful trade. But if the U.S. dollar depreciates by 10% against the Korean won during that exact same holding period,
your actual real return when you convert that money back to your home currency is zero.
Exactly. The currency fluctuation entirely neutralized the asset gain.
That really drives home the reality that the dollar is an active portfolio factor, not just a static measuring stick. It dynamically alters returns.
And we see this play out in commodity markets as well, right?
Oh, heavily. Commodities are deeply intertwined with the dollar regime. A strong dollar typically acts as a headwind for global commodities because it makes those raw materials more expensive for non-US buyers.
Which mechanically suppresses global demand.
Right. Now, gold presents a particularly nuanced dynamic. While it is often pressured by a strong dollar, the mechanics dictate that gold is fundamentally anti-real yield. Wait, before we move into that, let's explicitly define real yield for anyone listening who doesn't track bond market jargon daily. We are talking about the return an investor receives after factoring in the corrosive effect of inflation, correct?
That is the core calculation.
Yeah.
So if a U.S. Treasury bond pays a nominal yield of 5%, but inflation is running at 4%, your actual real yield is only 1%.
Right.
And gold yields absolutely nothing. It pays no interest. So when real yields on safe assets like treasuries are high, investors abandon gold.
Because why hold a rock when you can get paid interest?
Exactly. But when inflation outpaces interest rates, driving real yields negative, gold surges, it acts as a barometer of declining confidence in fiat monetary policy.
And how does the market treat Bitcoin within this framework? Let's unpack the definition here from the report because it is described as a high beta liquidity asset. Let's define high beta first.
Sure. In financial modeling, beta basically measures how aggressively an asset reacts to broader market movements. A high beta asset essentially acts as a volatile multiplier.
Okay, so it swings wildly.
Yes. Bitcoin trades as an incredibly sensitive gauge of global dollar liquidity. It tends to surge aggressively when the Fed expands the money supply and narratives surrounding dollar debasement gain traction.
Yeah, we've seen that.
Conversely, when global dollar liquidity tightens and cash yields are attractive, Bitcoin faces severe downward pressure.
So if the current operating system is this dominant and, frankly, this punishing to foreign markets when it fluctuates, it makes total sense why we constantly see headlines about countries trying to build alternative platforms.
Absolutely.
Let's look at the future threats, specifically de-dollarization and digital money.
Central bank digital currencies, or CBDCs, are obviously dominating policy discussions globally right now.
Right. Everyone's talking about them.
And many assume a digital yuan or a digital euro poses an immediate existential threat to the dollar. But the institutional analysis draws a very sharp mechanical distinction here, which a CBDC is fundamentally just a user interface update to the payment rails. It allows money to settle faster and cheaper. But upgrading the UI does not automatically manufacture the deep institutional trust required for a global reserve currency.
Right. A faster payment rail attached to a closed, politically opaque system is just a highly efficient way to move capital that global investors still don't want to hold.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This raises an important question about true network effects. You don't replace an operating system just by making a slightly faster app.
Which leads to a wildly counterintuitive finding regarding the crypto ecosystem. I mean, I would have naturally assumed that cryptocurrencies were designed to be the mortal enemy of the fiat dollar.
That's the popular narrative, yeah.
But the data in this June 2026 report suggests that stablecoins might actually be solidifying the dollar's dominance. How does that mechanism work?
The mechanism comes down to synthetic demand. Payment stablecoins are cryptographically designed to maintain a rigid one-to-one peg with the U.S. dollar.
Right.
To achieve that stability, the issuers must back their digital tokens with actual U.S. cash and ultra-safe U.S. treasuries.
I see.
So if a user in a developing market buys a stablecoin, they are indirectly forcing the issuer to buy a U.S. treasury bond to back it.
So stablecoins are essentially third-party apps functioning entirely on the dollar's native OS.
Exactly.
They aren't bypassing the dollar at all. They are aggressively extending its network effects into the decentralized web and into emerging markets.
They create a massive new channel of structural demand for U.S. debt.
So the external technological threats might actually be reinforcing the system. That means the real systemic threats aren't coming from outside the house. They are endogenous. They are originating from within the U.S. system itself.
Right.
Now, I want to explicitly state here for you listening, we are discussing highly sensitive geopolitical and fiscal realities. The source material does not take political sides, and neither do we. We are strictly analyzing the impartial math and the institutional incentive structures.
And looking at the hard numbers, there are two primary endogenous threats. The first is the sheer scale of U.S. sovereign debt.
Okay, lay out the numbers for us.
Based on Treasury fiscal data from the report, the total gross federal debt surpassed $39 trillion in mid-June 2026.
$39 trillion?
Yes. Issuing debt in your own reserve currency provides massive leeway, obviously, but it is not infinite. If chronic deficits and compounding interest costs begin to erode the perceived fiscal credibility of the U.S. government, global investors will mechanically demand a higher risk premium.
Meaning higher interest rates to hold U.S. assets.
Exactly.
It essentially functions like bloated legacy code. It slowly consumes more and more systemic memory until the system lags.
That's a great way to look at it.
And the second internal threat involves the geopolitical weaponization of the network. Specifically, the aggressive use of economic sanctions.
Sanctions are incredibly potent, precisely because they leverage the dollar's absolute dominance. Applying a sanction is the equivalent of revoking a user's API access to the global financial system.
You're just cut off.
Yes. However, if unaligned or neutral nations begin to perceive this tool as unpredictable or overly broad, it fundamentally alters their strategic risk calculus.
Yeah, I mean, if you realize the system administrator can turn off your business with a keystroke, your primary incentive is to instantly start coding a backup system.
Exactly. And the data indicates that the threat to the dollar is not a sudden overnight collapse where a rival currency takes the crown.
Right. It's not a flip of a switch.
No, the actual threat is a slow, methodical fragmentation. Countries gradually building parallel, redundant payment rails simply to ensure they have a functional backup when geopolitical tensions spike.
So what does this all mean for you? We started this deep dive by looking at a simple paper $20 bill in your wallet, and we've ended up staring at the source code of the global economy.
Quite a journey.
The dollar is not just a passive medium of exchange. It is an active portfolio factor. It is a defining macro signal. It operates as the master variable that links global risk appetite, emerging market stability, and commodity pricing.
Yeah, it touches everything.
Whether you are managing a complex hedge fund strategy or you're just trying to understand why the cost of gasoline is fluctuating, the dollar regime is the invisible architecture tilting the board.
It truly is the ultimate benchmark of global liquidity.
Right.
But, you know, it is crucial to remember that this status is not a permanent law of physics.
Right.
It is a systemic privilege maintained through institutional quality, deep market liquidity, and strategic restraint. And as we consider how digital innovation is actively rewriting these payment rails, I want to leave you with a final thought to ponder, kind of building on our discussion regarding stablecoins.
Sure.
If stablecoin infrastructure successfully extends the offshore dollar network directly to retail citizens in emerging markets, meaning individuals actively choosing to hold digital dollars on their smartphones to bypass the volatility of their own local currencies, does the U.S. Federal Reserve effectively and entirely unintentionally become the retail central bank for the entire global South?
No more.
And if that happens, what is the ultimate fate of financial sovereignty for nations when their own citizens seamlessly opt out of the local monetary system?
A completely digital, totally decentralized bank run toward the U.S. dollar. That is an incredibly heavy, fascinating concept to chew on.
It really is.
The next time you pull a bill out of your wallet, remember you aren't just holding a piece of paper. You're holding a user license to the world's most powerful operating system. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the infrastructure running the world around you, and we'll see you next time.